I'll hand over to Dave now, really, for us to start. Talk about Cornish Record.
Thank you very much. My name's David Cullen. I'm here to talk about records, West Country folk deals, and in particular talk about records in Cornwall. It's where I'm partly from. My mum is Cornish, part of the Cornish diaspora, which has been carrying on since about 1750. Cornwall was one of the only, was the only county in Britain where the population fell between 1801 and 1901. Cornish Records, what do we know about Cornish Records? What does everyone know about Cornish Records? They were the most evil, despicable people. They used to wait for the worst weather, and then they'd get up on top of the cliffs, and they'd hang lanterns up there and wave these lanterns, and ships would be struggling around the coast of Cornwall trying to find port, and they'd see these lanterns and they'd be drawn towards them, and they'd mistake them for navigational lights and signals, and they would be torn to pieces upon the rocks. And the Cornish people would come down onto the rocks and onto the beach, and they would scavenge everything off the ship. And if you were a sailor on that ship, you'd struggle to the shore as best you could, gasping, and a Cornish would stick your head, hold your head underwater and drown you. No question about it. Bite your finger off to take the gold ring off your finger. And whole communities would come and plunder the ship and take everything away. It's the common Cornish practice. And the Cornish are renowned for it. And there are rhymes and tales and songs about the men of Brag and Jermo who, you know, if you're going to be shipwrecked anywhere in the world is better to be shipwrecked than off the coast of Cornwall. Because the Cornish will show you no mercy. And this story of how the Cornish treated shipwreck victims has entered our culture and entered our consciousness, probably most notably through Daphne du Maurier's Jamaica Inn and Alfred Hitchcock's film Jamaica Inn, which has really embedded that idea of the Cornish as wreckers in the common consciousness and in the English culture. As a Cornishman, I've always found that myth a little bit difficult. I can still remember 1981 Penleigh lifeboat. 13 Cornishmen went down on the Penleigh lifeboat and died going out to save some people who weren't even English. They were going out to save in rough seas. And you think, well, how do those communities that would go out and risk their own lives and deprive their own families of themselves in order to rescue people, how are these the same people? How are they descended from the same people that would lure a ship onto the rocks and kill everybody on board in order to take what the cargo was? And how does that stack up? And I could never quite square those things in my mind. I could never quite square the idea of wrecking, that deliberate wrecking, with the fact that Cornwall has got a solid maritime history. And that, well, these people that are luring ships onto the rocks, well, they have brothers and uncles and fathers who were out at sea on ships. And they expect that to be okay if their brothers and uncles and fathers were struggling in bad weather and run aground somewhere for whoever the locals were to come and kill them and steal all their stuff? How does that stack up? Where's the reciprocity in that? Why did the Cornish think they were so special they could do that, but expect to be rescued themselves if they ran aground somewhere else? And that doesn't really add up. So when Rog told me what the theme was going to be, smugglers and pirates and witches for this Radical History Week, I thought, well, this is an opportunity to actually do a bit of work, do a bit of reading, and see what I can find out about these wreckers, this deliberate wrecking in Cornish history. And what I uncovered was an interesting and fascinating tale. The first thing I found was that no one ever in the history of England has been convicted of deliberate wrecking of a ship. Certainly no one's ever been convicted of luring a ship onto the rocks with false lights. They tried someone on Anglesey in the 1770s for luring a ship onto the rocks with false lights and for stealing from the wreck and for plundering and doing all sorts of other things. And they found him guilty for a lot of it, but they couldn't find him guilty of using false lights. And certainly never in Cornwall has anyone ever been tried for, even put on trial for using false lights to lure ships onto the rocks. The United States of America has got a bit of a history of using of trying and convicting people for luring ships with false rock, with false lights. But certainly there's no record of it in England. And there's one in Anglesey, but he got off of that bit, but got hung for a load of other things. And there's certainly nothing in the Cornish historical record to suggest that anyone ever did this. So then I've got a question in my mind, well, where on earth does the story come from? Did Daphne de Maurier make that up? Well, you know, she might have done, perhaps, I'm thinking. So, you know, I start to look around, and obviously, where do you start when you want to find anything out these days? Well, Google knows. Google knows. So I go into Google, wrecking, false lights, false signals, all that. And found a load of little websites, little Cornish villages and little bits of Cornish local history, and they're all there saying, this cove was notorious for wreckers, and they used to put false lights up, and they used to draw ships in, and they used to plunder them and kill the sailors. Well, no, they didn't. Well, if they did, you know, no one ever caught them doing it, and no one ever found them doing it. And I started to think about, well, what's the practicalities of this wrecking business? So, it's really bad weather, otherwise this isn't going to work. You know, you need it to be, you know, a full-on storm, a gale, and you're going to stand up on top of a cliff in the middle of the night, waving this lantern. I suppose you know there's a ship out there that you're wanting to lure onto the rocks, so you must know there's a ship out there, and you must know it's worth luring onto the rocks, because, you know, you're going to go to all this trouble and get up there and wave your lantern. What if, like, there was a famous wreck in the 1780s off Land's End, and it was full of salt? The Cornish made a big effort to save the crew off of that one, and the ship was full of salt, which just dissolved in the sea. So when you're up there with your lantern, you not only need to know there's a ship out there, but you need to know it's worth luring onto the rocks. And do you know that? And if you know it, well, how do you know it? And then I started to think about 18th, 19th century shipping trade and docks. You needed dozens and dozens of people to unload a ship in a perfectly calm harbour in the middle of the day. You know, that was fully labour intensive. And you got dozens and dozens of men. There weren't no big cranes. It wasn't all containerised. You had to get loads and loads of people to unload all this stuff onto the dockside and you know, to do it properly, as I said, in broad daylight in good weather. So you're going to do it in the middle of the night. You're going to do it on the most treacherous bit of coastline you can find, because that's where this is going to work. So what are you going to do? You're going to have to get nearly everybody in your community complicit in this murderous crime, prepared to come out in the middle of the night on the off, well, hoping it's not a ship full of salt, which is going to be totally worthless when it all breaks up on the rocks. They're going to have to scramble down over the cliffs and out onto the shore, and they're going to have to get the goods off of the ship in a force nine gale in the middle of the night and get away with it all before anybody turns up in the morning and start to think, ah, hang on a minute. You know, that doesn't really happen, does it? So the whole thing about the false lights is a myth. And where does it come from? And why is it there? And to start looking at the history of wrecks and wrecking, and what you find is that there's a whole load of confusion. Were any of you here for Roger's talk yesterday on the Branscombe Bay thing? Yeah. If you just raise your hand, because it would give me an idea of how much to gibber on about. I'm going to have to gibber on at the law quite a bit. There's quite a few of you weren't here, I'm afraid. And so those of you that were might hear it again. And if it's different to what Roger said, then I'm right, he's wrong. No, he's right, I'm wrong, whatever. So, if a ship gets wrecked and the goods get washed up on the shore, or the ship's wrecked out on the rocks just out there and you can get to it, who owns what gets washed up on the shore? Who owns what's left on the ship? Well, if all the crew and the captain, they've all drowned. You know, by the time you can get out there and try it out, it's too late, they're all dead. And there's left of that brandy and baccy and tea on there. You know, and these are the things you want. Who owns all that? Well, that's never really, you know, in the whole history of maritime trade around England, been very clear to anybody. You can sort of see a feudal approach to it, and then later on you can see a bourgeois approach to it or a capitalist approach to it. Feudal approach to it was, well, we're not quite sure who owns it, but the lord of the manor, where the stuff gets washed up or where the ship gets wrecked, is responsible for it. And so it's up to him really what happens to it, and he's supposed to salvage the stuff and hang on to it. So in theory, the ship gets wrecked, and the lord of the manor takes responsibility for it, and he gets some of his tenants and his serfs or whatever he's got, and he says to them, go on down on the beach, boys, and get all that stuff up, and I'll look after it for whoever owns it, and if they don't come along, it's mine. And actually he's got to hang on to it for a year and a day, and then it becomes his. Whoever owns it's got a year and a day to come and claim it. And if they do come and claim it after a year and a day, or is it 3 months? Or is it a week? Because the law says different things at different times. They've got to pay him a salvage value. And anybody who takes something off the beach and delivers it to the lord of the manor is entitled to half of the salvage value. And the salvage value is determined by the receiver of wrecks, who's actually set up in Windsor Castle, and he's a minion of the king, and he's got to do the wrecks for the whole of the country. And from time immemorial, in feudal times, so we're talking before 1688, before the 18th century, this has been the right of the lord of the manor. So it's the lord of the manor. Time immemorial, they decide, means 100 years. So if in the past 100 years there's been a wreck on your bit of coastline, and you took all of the goods, then you're entitled to do that, and your descendants are entitled to do that forever. But anybody who goes and helps and brings it all in is supposed to get half of the salvage value, but that gets determined in a year and a day's time how much that is. And it's all very, very confusing. And what it means is that people end up thinking, anything that gets washed up on the beach, I can just have that. That's what people think. People think it's providence. People think if a ship is wrecked, it's God's will. And you can see the motif of the shipwreck and the motif of problem at sea all through the culture. And actually, only one person ever succeeded, really, in calming the seas down when they was rough and preventing the shipwreck, and that was, you know, the bloke himself, Jesus Christ. And he did it in the Bible. But no one else can do that. Any shipwreck, that's God's will. And so if some goods come up on the beach near where you live, you go down and grab them. God wanted you to have them. That's fine. The lord of the manor might think he's supposed to have them and have half. But, you know, who knows about that? So there's a big confusion about who owns what. You get into the 18th century, after William and Mary, after the English Civil War, after the English Revolution, you've no longer got a feudal society, you've got a developing capitalist society, you've got a whole different emphasis on property. And the 18th century sees several attempts to codify and tighten up the law about who owns a wreck, who's entitled to salvage, who's responsible for the wreck, what you're supposed to do with wrecked goods. There are 22 bills that get to committee stage in the House of Commons during the 18th century. Only three make it onto the statute books. 1712, 1753 and 1767, I think. And the reason there's so much debate about it is every time they pass a law, it turns out there's a bit they haven't thought about, and people still think, well, I can just help myself to that. And when it comes to it, it's very difficult to prove that they can just help themselves to it. 1753 is the first time that false lights and luring ships and deliberate wrecking are mentioned in the law. And it's in 1753 that luring a ship in with your little lantern up on the cliffs becomes a crime for the first time. It's the first time it's mentioned in law, and is punishable by death. Usually killed for transportation, they say, but death is the punishment for that in 1753. These different laws in the 18th century are a result of constant lobbying, notably by the merchant venturers of Bristol, who were, you know, worried they're losing a load of money because the captains they employ aren't competent enough to actually get their ship from A to B and keep running them on the rocks. And they want some insurance against that, and they expect the law to provide that insurance. And you get some very punitive penalties for wrecking, and they actually hang an 80-year-old man in the 1770s in Cornwall for making off with a piece of rope from a wrecked ship. They make an example of him in North Cornwall, a recently appointed English magistrate in North Cornwall makes an example of an 80-year-old Cornishman for stealing a piece of rope from a ship because they're able to do that. And the law can never quite get to grips with the idea of wrecking. Never succeeded. It hadn't got to grips with the idea of wrecking for Branscombe Bay last year, as those of you who heard Roger yesterday will be fully aware. So, you get into the 19th century, And things get a bit more sophisticated, and we're in this scientific age that Kev was telling us about earlier on. And in the 1820s, Parliament does something sensible, and has an actual commission of inquiry into, well, why the hell are there so many shipwrecks? Between 1300 and 1900, there were 37 shipwrecks per mile of Cornish coastline, for instance. Cornwall's not the worst place for wrecks in the country. Kent and Sussex have more wrecks than Cornwall. Cornwall's only third in the list of wrecks per mile. But Cornwall's not really right next to London, where nearly everything's going, and there's a lot of wrecks around there because that waterway is particularly busy and there's a hell of a lot of stuff going in and out. So what the Commission of Inquiry does, it actually looks at why are there so many wrecks, and they end up listing 10 reasons. I can't remember all of them, but they're all health and safety at work issues. They're all about ships are being sunk because the crew's not properly trained. Ships are being wrecked because they're not loading them properly, and they just bung stuff in the hold because they're busy and they're in a hurry, and then the thing tips over as soon as the water gets a bit rough. Ships aren't being maintained properly, they're not being built properly. The maps that are available for people to navigate aren't adequate. Nowhere in this list of reasons for a shipwreck is there anything about false lights being waved out and people luring them onto the rocks. You know, and there's a full commission, full parliamentary inquiry. And the laws start to get framed which address the health and safety at work issues and the technology issues. They're not bothered about mariners drowning. They're bothered about the brandy and the tea and the baccy getting where it's supposed to get so people can make money. You know. Approaches to the law change. The false lights thing, there's an act, I think, in 1822, which reduces all the penalties involved for scavenging from wrecks, which recodifies the salvage issue, and there's no more death penalty. It's all about fines by then and some imprisonment, which mostly comes from not paying your fine for getting the stuff. The fine is double the value of what you've taken, basically, in most cases. And false lights disappear from the legislation and from the law in the 1820s. So they're on the law for about 70 years. The law's saying you can't wave false lights and lure ships in. It's bad. It's naughty. And that disappears then following this, you know, full-on parliamentary inquiry. There's no need for it. So this false lights thing's a bit of an issue. It was against the law for 70 years. There's no record of it. You know, only one person got tried for it, and they didn't get convicted of it. No one else, and certainly no one in Cornwall. So, why is it? Why is there this powerful myth attached to the Cornish? I haven't able to answer that question. Why is this wrecking thing so strong? Such a strong symbol. Still in people's consciousness. Why was Daphne du Maurier so interested in it? Why was Winston Graham so interested in it in Poldark, on the telly in the 70s? They got to wrecking activities in that. Why do the Cornish still sell that idea to the tourists that go down there every summer? And they certainly do, you know. And us Cornish might resent being thought of as being murderous wreckers on one hand, but on the other hand, it sells postcards and little trinkets to, you know, tourists, so we'll have some of that as well. There's a slightly double-headed approach to that. And there's three things. In the 19th century, there's still great concern about the property issue. Whose property is it when it washes up on the beach? And what the merchant class don't, and the capitalist class and the trading class don't want, whoever else's stuff it is, it don't belong to the people that have gone down on the beach to get it. That's for down shore. It's ours. You know, and we want to keep it. But that's extremely difficult. In Cornwall in the 19th century, wrecks happen. People flock down onto the beach, and they do flock down onto the beach in their dozens and maybe hundreds sometimes, depending on what's washed up and when it's washed up. The local tin mine owners don't like it because the tinners don't turn up for work. Because do you want to be 200 feet underground hacking away at granite trying to get some tin ore out of that to earn tuppence a week, Or do you want to pop down the beach, see what you can pick up down there, and maybe make yourself a few quid and rest up for a few weeks? So the tin magnates, as they are, don't like it. The merchants don't like it. The revenue don't like it. There's no revenue payable on shipwrecked goods. So once it's shipwrecked, they've lost the chance of getting an import duty on it anyway. So people still think they can help themselves. Some people still think the Lord of the Manor is entitled to have. They like to send the customs in, the authorities, there's a shipwreck, and they send a horse out to the customs officer and say to the customs officer, get down on the beach, they're plundering a wreck. The customs officer turns up and the wreckers are picking this wreck clean and picking stuff off the beach, saying, none of your business. This isn't being imported, this has been wrecked. It's none of your business. And customs officers are quoted as saying, reporting back, saying, well, what can I do? There's no duty payable on wreck. It's not my job to police these wrecks. You know, I haven't got a mandate, I haven't got authority to deal with these wrecks. The receiver of wrecks hasn't actually got any staff. He can't actually do anything much about it. They've codified the idea of salvage, and if you go and rescue people off a ship and pull the goods off the ship that's foundering and hand them over to the correct authorities, the receiver of wrecks or his designated representative, you're entitled to salvage value. And they work out salvage value, and actually that's quite tidy. And so what Cornish people are doing is they're picking wrecks up, and there's three or four examples of this in the early 1820s, where they go out and they risk their own lives, and they rescue the crew, and they get the goods off, and they turn them over to the representative of the receiver of wrecks, and say, right, chummy, you owe me one-tenth of the value of that cargo, whatever it is. And the receiver of wrecks representative said, yep, you're absolutely right. And 2 years later, they still don't have the money. So they go back to just picking the ship clean and taking it all out and saying to the customs officers who turn up, it's nothing to do with you, chummy. They get this reputation for being so fearsome that they'll even break into the customs house and liberate back the wrecked goods on the occasions when the customs officer does take some of it away, which they do sometimes. But it's not anything to do with the customs officer. They're turning up, they're saying, we went and got that off the ship, we went and picked it off the beach, it ain't for you to have in the customs house, it's not liable for duty. So the law fails, really, to tackle the problem, as merchants would see it, and as the capitalist class would see it, fails to tackle the problem of wrecking and what happens to those goods. And actually, they don't want it going to the poor working people because it's not their property, they're not damn well entitled to it, and the buggers won't turn up to work for 3 weeks. And we can't get anything out of them that way. So they really don't like it, but the law is ineffective. The bureaucracy can't reward those people with the salvage value quickly enough for them to take it seriously. And that system, particularly in Cornwall, breaks down. So the Cornish carry on a long tradition of beachcombing, picking stuff off the beach, and even going out onto foundering ships and taking stuff off, and they cart it off home. The authorities don't like that, but they've got to deal with it in some way. And what it seems happens in the 19th century is they create a moral panic, and they use the press and they use the clergy and they use literature to do it, and that seems to be the answer. And I'm much indebted to Dr. Catherine Pierce of the University of Alaska, who kindly sent me her PhD thesis. She's just been awarded her PhD this year 4 or 5 days ago, and she's done a thesis on Cornish wrecking. And I'm indebted to her for a lot of the information that I've been able to share with you, and I must apologise to her if she ever hears this or hears any of you talk about it for any errors and mistakes which are all mine.
It's verbatim, isn't it?
So there's this moral panic, and big in promoting this moral panic is a media called the Sherborne Mercury, the biggest selling newspaper in Cornwall. From 1790, maybe up to 1890, the most read newspaper in Cornwall. And they just love wrecks. Everybody loves shipwrecks, actually. And, you know, shipwrecks have been a powerful motif, you know, throughout our culture, from Jesus quelling the seas, when he was out with the disciples and they were all frightened. Shakespeare's full of shipwrecks. Loads of his plays have got shipwrecks in. Shipwrecks are crucial, for instance, in The Winter's Tale. there's that full fathom five thy father lies in the Tempest. So Shakespeare has got loads of shipwrecks. If you look at the earliest printed materials available in English, they were these broadsheet things that used to get handed around, and they just used to go mad for shipwrecks. You know, a great story, people surviving shipwrecks, dying in shipwrecks. Robinson Crusoe was shipwrecked. Swiss Family Robinson was shipwrecked. You know, all sorts of people have been shipwrecked. Really big motif, really interesting. Anyway, the Sherborne Mercury used to go mad for wrecking. And there's some lovely examples. It's one in the 1830s where they describe this most bacchanalian scene on Marazine Beach. In Mounts Bay, ships run aground, it's full of brandy. And thousands of men, women and children, all the tinners from Brig and Germo, swarm down on the beach, break open the barrels of brandy, and they're drinking it out of their shoes, and they're drinking it out of their hats. The local worthies are frightened by this. They've killed the crew. A couple of the crew survived, they've been murdered. Troops get sent in, and are beaten back by the mob, and they kill two or three soldiers. And they end up, the women end up fighting amongst themselves over fripperies and trifles. And to the state where they are near naked. Several of these wreckers drink so much of this brandy, they lie insensible in country lanes and die of exposure and found dead next morning. And it's a terrible, terrible scandal. The troops can't control them. They're absolutely mad, unholy, barbarian, blah. And that's on the front page of the Sherborne Mercury. Following week, following issue, whatever that is, they say, a correction to last week's conduct, good. What actually happened was absolutely nothing. They had got drunk on the brandy. There weren't thousands of them, there were dozens of them. They'd risked their lives, actually, getting the crew off the ship and getting the goods off the ship. And the goods were there available, and they were actually keeping it there for salvage. They buggered off with it after the Sherborne Mercury thing, I can assure you. So every opportunity to whip up wrecking, it sold newspapers. It was a lovely story. You know, I mean, and
naked women.
Naked women, drunken naked women fighting over trifles and fripperies. Yeah, any better than that, can you? And you know, people dying of their excess. And involving, they had children, they were involving children, they were pouring brandy down the children. Oh, terrible, terrible thing. The clergy get whipped up into it, and they really start in the 1830s and 1840s, partly by statute, because they are preaching against wrecking quite comprehensively, and the Methodist Church really don't like people scavenging from wrecks, mainly because they don't like the drinking and they don't like the lawlessness and the anarchy which they believe would inevitably flow from strong drink. And there are four or five Methodist novels written in the 1840s and 1850s set in Cornwall, and the central characters are wreckers. And they're not just wreckers who go down on the beach and pick up the stuff that's come in by the will of God. They're the ones that try and pervert the will of God by waving these damn lanterns out the sea. They don't just wave lanterns. They make rafts out of gorse and put lanterns on them and create entire phantom villages and harbours. To draw people in and to draw ships in, and then they go and bite their fingers off and murder them and kill them and drown them, and they get the captain's wife and drown her and steal her wedding ring, and they do all that sort of thing. And these characters come to rack and ruin, obviously. These are proselytising texts written to be read aloud, written to be engaging, written for people to be interested in. They're episodic and they come out in instalments, and people love them. There's one, the most famous one is reprinted, runs to 27 reprints between 1850 and 1880. So these are powerfully strong tales, all of which go to build this myth that what the Cornish did, you know, was lure people onto the rocks. And what's happening here is, well, the law has proved itself powerless to stop people scavenging off of wrecked ships. So we're going to try and make it sure it's an evil, bad thing to do. And if you get involved in that wrecking, and you get involved in that beachcombing, well, how do you know those poor buggers weren't lured in? and you're then an accessory to murder. And as you know, you're not encouraging that practice of luring in, and maybe other people might start luring people in, and then your brother and your uncle and your son, who's working on a ship, he might get lured in off Ireland. He might get lured in off Anglesey. He might get lured in off France. And it starts to make that beachcombing and collecting wrecked goods starts to make that evil. And it starts to make, you know, starts to undermine all that. So it and hopefully becomes morally very difficult for people to do. It enters the official history of Cornwall in the 1906 publication of the Victoria County Histories. The Queen Victoria commissioned county histories of every county in England, and she employed teams of historians to write the official history of every county in England, and the 1906 Victoria County History of Cornwall contains the false lights myth that's been picked up from this primarily Methodist literature, but also from the nonsense that the Sherborne Mercury used to put out in order to sell its newspapers.
She died in 1901.
Yeah, she commissioned them in the 1870s. The Victoria County History of Gloucestershire was completed, I think, in 1995. There are still some counties that haven't completed their Victoria County histories. So it might have been her Golden Jubilee she commissioned them, so that would have been 87. Quite why the myth has become so attached to the Cornish in particular, I haven't been able to find out, and that was the bit I was really interested in. So, you know, I haven't got an answer to my own question. That's about all I've got to say, probably. I don't expect I've got the answers to any of your questions either, because I've probably exhausted what I know about it, but I'm willing to try if any of you think that would be helpful and fruitful way to spend the next 5 minutes in asking me questions. You're more than welcome, and thank you for your patience. Because they didn't know how to load ships properly, they didn't know how to drive ships properly, they didn't, all those reasons that it was busy. And you've got...
where are they all coming from then?
Well, down the Bristol Channel and round to London, a lot of stuff.
Oh.
And then coming over the Atlantic and into the English Channel to get round to London, or up to Bristol.
Giving it a wider berth.
Yeah, most of the maritime trade and most of the ships that were punting stuff around England through the 18th and 19th century were going from one English port to another and would stay close to the coast. The railways later on into the second half of the 19th century reduce that, and shipping becomes more international. But really, until the railways really get going and get cooking, everything gets moved by water. And so you've got the canal network which comes into the sea, and so lots and lots of stuff will be going around Cornwall. And Cornwall's got a nasty coast, and you've got the Atlantic you're dealing with, not smaller waterways. Yes, sir.
Yes, either for you or for anyone, but didn't that BBC tele programme Coast do something on wrecking? Because they did some kind of reenactment where they... I can't for the life of me remember whether they perpetuated the myth or whether they...
I heard that,
They got out as fact, was it?
So my question is, what can we do about that?
Well, Dr. Catherine Pearce's PhD is going to be published as a book next year, and she's quite determined to nail that myth in particular. What we can do about it, I suppose, is you can come along and listen to fools like me and tell all your friends, and maybe, you know, I'll have to have a look at this coast thing, because certainly there's no evidence. It may have happened. There are still historians, and some what you think to be serious historians, who say, well, there's no evidence to say anyone lured a ship in, but it was on the statutes. They wouldn't have made it against the law if it didn't happen. So, there is still some thought that it probably did happen.
Twice as bad if you use donkeys.
just taking both talks, bringing them both together. you're saying that a lot of the wrecks around Cornwall were really just sort of brought on by people encouraging ships onto the coast. But from following on from what Kev was saying earlier, so there must have been ways of administering craft to get out to ships that are on the way through. You know, when you get on towards, I mean, when you pull it up along the English Channel, I mean, it starts to sort of narrow up a bit. And Poole was quite a big harbour. It was a busy port. So surely it would have been... So how were these people who were supposedly downtrodden, labourers, blah, 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 and I guess the same situation would have been familiar with Cornwall, but not so much as it would have been Poole, but how do these people actually get out there and muster the money to get a ship, to get a boat, to get out there and do some pillaging on the seas? Because surely that would have been a better way of going about it than...
Yeah. I mean, certainly, the whole smuggling phenomenon, 1 ounce of tea had duty paid on it for every pound of tea that didn't have duty paid on it. That's where the money was going to be made. You're not going to make any money stood up on top of a bloody cliff top like that. If you're prepared to do that, you'd be much better off actually trying to do some serious smuggling. It'd be a lot easier, a lot safer, and the returns would be a lot
you
more
get better quality goods. Yeah.
And you get better quality goods, and you haven't got messed up by the sea.
Can I just say, on the south coast of Cornwall, certainly, they used to run these little 18-foot luggers, which were open deck boats, and they were very skilled sailors. And they could run from Foy to Rostock, which is 100 miles, in 8 hours on a good day. And there's a record of one doing that, picking up the boots, going back, offloading, going back again.
Is that second or back again?
Gigs. No, luggers. Yeah.
Well, it's quite interesting to see that. That's,
so they're running the goods, they're getting them from France and coming back with them. They're not meeting boats, certainly in that situation.
Yeah.
But other smugglers would be meeting boats in other situations, like the Bristol Channel. Mm.
I was quite interested to see that shot that you showed, Kev, of the Kentish smugglers coming over, and there was, in the background, you can see a ship there. I wonder how much of it was... Actually, because you're talking about a lot of booty there that's, you know, in a safe, secure place. How much of it actually would have gone... Because it wouldn't take too long to get from Dorset down to the Kentish coast on the sea. Why take it overland? You know, you know what I mean? How much of it would have been like chipping off each other and, you know, ripping off each other like it? Like smuggle off each other. Oh, sure.
Well, yeah, we haven't got a lot of time now. We want to show Whiskey Galore, so I'm going to stop the questions. That's all right. But,
yeah, that's better.